the Brain Science Podcast, the podcast for everyone who has a brain, and I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell. On the Brain Science Podcast, we explore how recent discoveries in neuroscience are unraveling the mysteries of how our brains make us who we are. For more information, including show notes, links to previous episodes, and information about how to subscribe, please go to the website brainsciencepodcast.com. We also have a discussion forum at brainscienceforum.com, and you can send me email at docartemis@gmail.com. Welcome back to the Brain Science Podcast. This is episode 45. Today's guest is Dr. John Reddy from Harvard Medical School. He's our first return guest. Back in episode 33, he told us about why exercise is good for our brains. Today, he's going to be talking about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Now, the Brain Science Podcast rarely focuses on specific diseases, but this is certainly one that affects millions of people of all ages. Before I start, I do want to thank everyone who has contributed to help support the Brain Science Podcast. If you want to help support the show, all you need to do is go to brainsciencepodcast.com and you will see a tab at the top of the page where you can get more information. Let's get on into the interview. John, it's great to have you back on the show.
It's great to be back. I loved it the last time, and I'm looking forward to today.
You realize you're my first return guest.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, my Lord. That's great.
So do you mind if we just jump right into our official discussion?
No, let's move.
I'm going to start with a real basic question. Can you tell us what attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is?
Well, ADD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is a really a problem with attention. And the real name of it should be attention variability disorder. It's a problem with focusing, with staying with the focus, with distractibility, and if they have the hyperactivity component, a problem remaining still or being impulsive, however you choose to look at it.
Is it really a single disorder, or is it really a spectrum?
Oh, attention deficit disorder is a wide, wide spectrum. Like most of our real psychiatric issues, it's a spectrum that goes from a little bit to quite a bit. And we all today probably have ADHD because of our culture, because of the media. And the sense is that we can't really attend like we'd like to for most of us.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if kids growing up on the way they do TV and video games, if that's not actually making it worse.
We said that our culture is ADDogenic, meaning that it helps bring out the disorder and also doesn't train the brain like it needs to be trained to stay with things, to stand frustration, to look for the process rather than the endpoint, meaning we go for the gold or go for the highest intensity, and we can by hitting a button rather than looking at the whole thing and appreciating the time spent in getting there.
I know that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that people not put children under the age of 2 in front of the TV set. Do you think that that matters? Do we have any solid evidence about that?
Well, I'll tell you, I think there's conflicting evidence about all kinds of things around that. I mean, the early reports were if you had a TV in the room of an infant, whether it's on or not, which really means it was a sort of an epidemiologic look at it, it seemed to code for a later onset of attentional problems and behavioral problems. And then there were other studies showing that that wasn't the case, but I do think that our whole cyber culture has a big part to play in the increased incidence of attentional problems. I mean, if you think about it, when you can click and flick and start over again with the video games or get away from the commercial, or if something's slow, you click over to another channel or you surf on the internet. What does that say for sticking with something and training people to contemplate and sort of use their own inner resources to deal with situations that may require standing a lot more frustration, not having the answer, thinking about it? I mean, we're all liable for it. I mean, look at most people who use the internet a lot, Google the spelling of words, even that they know how to spell it or almost know, but they don't tax their brain if they're writing something. I know I do it myself. And I quickly go to, oh, is it this way or that way? Or the spell check will come up with it.
Yeah, me too.
I know. I mean, we all are liable for it. And then you start worrying, well, do I lose my ability to spell? We've all been seduced into not taxing ourselves, not paying attention to our inner life, if you will, long enough to get the right spelling or to get the right word even.
Well, let's back up from the cultural for a few minutes. Do we know anything at the biological level about what causes ADD?
Oh, yeah, we know a heck of a lot. I think there's lots and lots of evidence that this is a biological disorder, the real megilla of it. And I think that it's safe to say we know that it's genetically transmitted, that there is a syndrome that's passed on in families. I like to say that it's a 30% rule in terms of understanding the genetics. That is, almost any question you might ask about genetics in terms of inheritance of ADD is around 30 to 40%. In other words, if a parent has it, 30% likely a child will. If a child has it, it's 30% or so likely that one of their siblings will have it. And if a child has it, it's 30% likely that one of the parents will have it. So it shows a very heavy inheritance factor, and the genes that are involved that have been identified are many. In fact, one of the early gene hunters 10 years ago was looking at about 43 different genes that had been identified as a gene that's associated with attentional problems. Most of it, however, has been focused on some of the genes that are involved with the two major neurotransmitters, dopamine and norepinephrine. So if you have a gene variant in one of these, you're much more in the ballpark of thinking about this is involved with attentional problems.
So you want to talk a little bit about, I know this was a focus in your book, A User's Guide to the Brain, about the role of the intentional systems. Why are those so important?
Well, the attentional system is really, I see it as the bridge and the tying up of many different brain functions. It links together our thinking, our memory, our considering. It links together different parts of the brain, and I see it as sort of this inner bridge, because the attentional system really runs really from the on button down in the brainstem, the arousal center and the arousal sleep center, up through the limbic system and sort of having an important veer off into the cerebellum and then back through the motor system and up into the frontal cortex. And these are important, important channels that run really in the center of the brain to tie up a lot of different systems and a lot of different issues. And looking back historically at what we first called minimal brain dysfunction and childhood hyperactivity disorder, when people began to notice and talk about it and trying to understand it, we talked about a problem with arousal. And that's still part of the problem. It's an arousal problem, that is, not being aroused enough in certain situations, or being over-aroused too much of the time for some people. Then up through the limbic system, another couple decades later in the 90s, we were talking about a motivational problem, a biologic motivational problem, meaning that there wasn't enough oomph to sustain the attention on whatever it was that the person was trying to do or was supposed to be doing. And then most recently, in the past 15 years or so, we've been focusing on what we call the frontal executive, or the executive function problem that people with ADD have, which is where now most people are talking about it or thinking about it as a problem, with the ability to sequence, to sustain your attention, to screen out other stimuli that are coming in or other options, and to hold in mind long enough to consider the consequences of an action or to consider what you want to do with the information in your brain. So it really sort of travels the whole gamut, really, of human experience.
And the attentional system kind of ties all these pieces together.
Right. The two neurotransmitters that have been most associated with ADD are, and I'll say ADD rather than ADHD, out of old habit, because the H was added sometime in the 80s, and we started long before that. But the two major neurotransmitters that are associated with are norepinephrine and dopamine. And norepinephrine begins and have most of its cell bodies in the brain in the arousal center and the alert center, and turns the whole brain on and wakes us up. This is a big part of the attentional network. The second major neurotransmitter, the one that's most associated with attentional issues, is dopamine, which is really concentrated in the limbic area and in the motor area, but very closely allied one to another.
I was going to ask you about the relationship between ADD and addiction. I know it's not the most important, but it kind of leads into the whole dopamine and reward system issues, I think.
Right. No, you're right. It does. The limbic part of the attention system, the way I see it, is this area called the mesolimbic dopamine system, which is considered the reward network, the addiction network, the seeking system, it's called by some. And this is a very important dopamine tract that runs from one end of the limbic system to the other. And this is an area where most of our addictionologists have been focusing for now many decades, or two decades anyway, on what's going on in this system, and especially at the end of it, where we have the nucleus accumbens, which is a little area that's been called the pleasure button or the reward center. And it's very highly involved with dopamine. One of the things that happens, and you can see with people with attentional problems, is that they don't have enough motivation to sustain their attention in situations that aren't highly charged. So they are seeking high-intensity activities or high-intensity situations. This is what you see, too, with the people that are prone to addictions. So with ADD, for instance, we see at least twice as many people who have problems with substance abuse in untreated ADD than in those who were treated, especially in their adolescence. So you see this over much, the people with all kinds of substance problems or abuse problems or addiction problems. And that's why, for instance, one of the big problems in ADD in children these days is the addiction to video games, which are very, very highly addictive for people with ADD because there's not enough dopamine receptors in some, or they're too sensitive in others, so that you can have this situation easily set up.
And then, of course, people like me, I've in the past misunderstood that kind of behavior. I think I mentioned when I was talking to you last time that I had been a skeptic about the whole thing, because I look at somebody who's playing a video game for hours on end and I'm thinking, well, they can pay attention if they want to, because I didn't understand the difference until I read what you wrote about it.
Right. It is different because the one is a highly, highly charged environment. It's just the same way we're thinking now, more so as addiction as a disease model as opposed to a choice model. And this is the problem often, that people mistake things like that. We make a moral judgment on things, not to give everybody a free pass or get out of jail free card. It's not about that. It's just understanding the brain a bit and how that contributes to the situation. That's why it's so important early on to see this tendency to make some environmental changes in that child's life, hopefully, that can help them not give way to their tendency to get hooked on video games or on drugs and alcohol, whatever it might be, or smoking, for instance. Nicotine is a huge problem with, again, it's sort of at least twice as frequently amongst people who have ADD or can't get off the nicotine habit. It is something that we tend to moralize and see, okay, they can do it if they want to. The answer is yes, they can, if they have enough support, structure, awareness to know their brain and how they must manage it, and support to do that. Obviously, then we have medicine that helps sustain the attention and the focus on things that don't have that kind of juice, like the next World of Warcraft level that you might go to, or the Doom level. That's the last video game I ever played and got seduced into that long ago. So I haven't seen the new environment yet that the kids are all having such trouble with.
It's even so much more realistic now with the graphics. That's got to make it.
Oh, yeah.
I enjoy video games, but I haven't had much time to play them since I started podcasting. When I was playing, I don't think I have any ADD, and I could play for an hour and quit. I noticed that a lot of people just go on and on and on.
Right, right, and that's a big problem. And as like you, you know, the teachers and the parents see the same thing. They say, Jesus, Jimmy can sit there for 4 hours straight or 8 hours or 12 hours, but they can't sit in school for 10 minutes or 5 seconds even and stay attentive to the page. Well, it's a very different Megillah sitting in front of a wonderful creative environment that's so stimulating and challenging and has more of a personal involvement. It really has a survival issue, see, you know, surviving, you know, think about the levels, especially the most of the games that I'm familiar with in the past, and now I'm sure World of Warcraft and some of the other games, it's if you don't do something right, you lose your person, or you lose the game. You end the challenge. You lose a survival battle. This is very compelling. It really is a big part of what the draw is and why learning a French word doesn't seem to have immediate kind of consequence. And if we think about it from a pure survival issue, a pure evolutionary issue, which is, I think, the way to think about reward and attention even, because when we're in the survival mode, we do really well with our attentional system. That's why, for instance, the ADD people have been very good in survival situations or in crisis situations. All of a sudden, they can be very logical. They can be extremely competent in directing things or living up to the challenges of the moment.
Yeah, and I read a book, I can't remember the name of it because it was several years ago, by an education person. It was actually about the way that good video games work in terms of encouraging learning. And the guy was saying that people ought to look at them and see what it is that they do differently from the way schools work. That gets kind of back to what you were saying about trying to reform schools. I mean, well, I don't think we can make learning French seem like a survival skill. We could certainly improve the way we teach it.
Well, yes, we can.
That's why immersion works, right, with foreign languages. If you're stuck in a situation where you have to learn to speak it in order to communicate, you can learn it, right?
Exactly, exactly. I always use French because I took 2 years in high school, and I just played around in that, and I had good enough compensatory powers to deal with it and pass the test, but I never really loved any part of it.
Yeah.
Until I went to France, and then I realized, oh my God, I wish I would have paid attention more and really taken it in. But that's the way it goes. It's true. Our school environment, and much like our work environment, for most of us, MDs are a little different because we're moving around a little more throughout the day and we're not wedded to one thing after another. But our school situation and workplace situation, sitting in front of a computer, for most people these days, it's sort of anti-evolution. We're movers, we're hunter-gatherers from a movement perspective and from moving around, and our attention system is geared for us to be moving and doing and not just passively taking information in. But then there are those who have less ability to sit there and take in the information in this very artificial environment unless you get hooked on it, unless you really say, okay, I'm going to make myself, challenge myself to get everything that is coming at me in and know it. You sort of make a game of it. And that's why you see competitive people who have ADD who can do extraordinarily well. Look at Michael Phelps, who was diagnosed with ADD and on Ritalin at the age of 9 and then started swimming at 10 and then said hello to his mom, who's a school principal and has high educational values, convinced his mom that he should be off the Ritalin. It didn't really help his school. It did about a letter grade, but he just felt confined by it. And so he hasn't been on his ADD medicine since he's 11, but he's been in the pool 3 or 4 hours a day. And we see now he's at 6 out of the 8 challenges for his gold medals. I think that's a good example of someone who has found his mission. Each race is a survival issue to beat the other guy and to beat the world record. And he's certainly someone that everybody can admire and see how he's done so well. But part of that is he's found that mission and drive to do what he needs to do to succeed and survive. And this is an important area for people with kids and themselves who have ADD is to find that mission and then to go for it and stay on it. This is an important area for people with kids and themselves who have ADD is to find that mission and then to go for it and stay on it.
And from a diagnostic perspective, it sounds like we need to start looking at both problems like addiction and ADD differently. Maybe we need a new category like reward deficiency syndromes that's more biological and less judgmental.
Right. Well, you see, that's really right on. That people that might have this tendency that have the reward deficiency syndrome was first identified in relationship to chronic, unremitting alcoholics who ended up dying of cirrhosis. They found that this group of people had a problem or a difference in their genes, the genetic difference, that coded for less dopamine receptors, the dopamine 2 receptors. And this is important in the reward center. So they tended to be the ones searching for a high stimulus situation. Then it was found to be involved with all kinds of addiction problems and a slight crossover at times for people with attentional problems. And now we're more focused on other dopamine receptors and the dopamine transporter and the dopamine enzyme chain that makes dopamine in the cell. All these are part of the same area that there's this need for enough of a stimulus out there, enough of a challenge for the whole system to overcome the difference, if you will. 10,000, 15,000 years ago, when we were out on the plains and hunter-gatherers, the people with ADD were probably the hunters, the ones that were always on the move, that were always having to pay attention because it was a survival issue. That probably is the reason why we have such a high percentage of people who in this environment show problems with their attention system. I mean, they can't quite stay with the boring material or stay focused long enough. Whereas in the past, they were seen as being the leaders. In fact, that's what we see today, too. Not only Michael Phelps winning gold medals, but Rick Warren leading this purpose-driven church that he's on the cover of Time magazine this week. And he's begins talking about his ADD and his restlessness and his inability to sort of stay with one thing, but constantly searching for other areas to make his mark or to help drive his mission, which he's tireless pursuing and changing the world. and, you know, sold 40 million books on how we need to get so much more behind our purpose and our mission. And I think that's instructive for the people who are prone to addiction or prone to this restlessness and need to get fixed and focused all the time.
One of the things that surprised me when I was reading your book that I didn't know at all was the importance of memory. And can you talk a little bit about the role memory plays in ADD?
Sure. Memory is really important because it's one of the key facts of people with ADD is that they have a problem with working memory. Throughout the various tests, when you really look at ADD folks on their neuropsych exams, working memory is always a bit challenged when they do an elaborate test, partly because their frontal cortex is what I call a sleepy cortex. It has to be woken up all the time. It has to be jazzed. You have to have that mission. And if you don't, then your RAM chip, which is in your frontal cortex, is less empowered. There's less energy in there, if you will. You have less ability to hold things in mind for a longer period of time. And it's a really important area. And one of the things you see is that, for instance, your child that might be addicted to video games, that they can remember all kinds of things when they're sitting in front of the computer, but can't remember things in school or can't pay attention longer or can't hold in mind anything for their organizational problems or what they're supposed to be doing, because this area of the brain is sort of not turned on enough. It's not lit up. The wire that goes to the frontal cortex is frayed, and there's not enough voltage going through to turn on the RAM chip. That's the way I visualize it anyway.
Can you define for my listeners exactly what you mean by working memory?
Working memory is really short-term memory. It's the ability to hold in mind issues that you want to consider that are presented to you that you need to hold it long enough to encode it or get it put into the hippocampus and various areas of the brain that are all connected to wire in the memory. You need to hold it in mind long enough to be able to consider it long enough so that you can log it in or that you can stay with it. For instance, one of the ways I think of procrastination, which is a huge problem with people with ADD, they're masters at it. We're all good procrastinators, but I mean, and I have some of this ADD too myself, and I know that I procrastinate, and that part of why I can procrastinate and others with ADD can procrastinate so well is that they absolutely forget what they're supposed to be doing. Sometimes willingly, but often it just goes away because they can't hold it in mind long enough. In this sense, it's holding what their real motivation is long enough in mind to accomplish their task or their mission.
So, like, if you're a parent and you tell your kid to take out the garbage or do some task and he forgets it, and you say, okay, well, he really did forget it. Once you get past the whole problem of being able to believe that, is there anything you can do to help a person have a better working memory for mundane things?
It's hard. That's where we use all the structuring techniques and what I call environmental engineering techniques. You engineer your environment to help you with your deficits, if you will, with your brain issues. For instance, fear of punishment can work somewhat, but that's a horrible way to do it. But also helping them train themselves to know, first of all, that they're going to forget and that they need to take a second and think about it. So hopefully they can make less errors and forget things less often, like taking out the garbage. And that's why one of the mantras for ADD is Ohio, only handle it once. If you have to do something, you do it right now, because in 30 seconds, it's likely you're not going to remember what it was you were wanting to do or having to do. And that goes across the board. That's one way of dealing with it. The other is really taking the time to plan, which is anathema to someone with ADD. I say people with ADD are allergic to structure, meaning they rebel against it, but at the same time, they know they absolutely need it. And this is the problem. They were rebelling at it and needing it at the same time. So they need to acknowledge that they have this need for structure, and so they can employ the wonderful computer and other electronic devices that we have that can help us manage our lives and our goals so much more accurately and remind us. Or they can set up systems using partnerships or collaborative efforts to help remind them. Working with somebody is a reminder all the time that they have to do this kind of thing. For instance, one of the great studies that was done with ADD kids some years ago was having a group of ADD children and a group of controls putting together a jigsaw puzzle and timing them. Then they did the same level of difficulty of a jigsaw puzzle, another one, for a second test and timed them. But this time they put a mirror up in front of each of the child's desk so that the mirror would show exactly what they were doing. Then they timed them again. So you had four different trials, two controls and two of the ADD kids, one with the mirror up and one with the mirror down. The same with the controls. Three of the groups all had the same times, approximately. The two controls, in either with the mirror up or mirror down, and the ADD kids with the mirror up. With the mirror down, or the first episode, they were 30% longer it took them to put together the jigsaw puzzle. So the mirror itself, it's called mirror therapy. Now, some people talk about it. The mirror would merely reflect back on the child, oh, I'm putting together this jigsaw puzzle, as opposed to sort of looking up from the puzzle and sort of spacing out. That mirror was a constant reminder that this is what they were doing. It's really quite interesting, and it's one of the things that I talk about with people with ADD who hire someone to help them with their homework. Oftentimes, the help is they're just being there. They remind them that they're supposed to be studying or reading or writing, whatever it is they're writing, and occasionally may help with questions and what have you, but oftentimes they're just needing that person to reflect back on them that they're supposed to be doing their work and they can't go off and surf the net or get up and get another magazine to read in the library and what have you. And that's why one of the ways of dealing with ADD, with college students especially, is to organize study groups so that the person knows that they'll procrastinate and they'll forget and they'll get involved in other things. With the study group, they're much more liable to do their work and to, working with another person or another group to not get behind, which is a big problem.
So that means that some of the solutions to this are not really anything high-tech or complicated. There can be simpler than you might think.
Absolutely. It can be very simple. But first, like for instance, the instance you brought up of the child forgetting everything. You know, the parent, instead of just chronically yelling at them or being disappointed, can sit and have them sort of reflect, no matter what age, reflect, okay, you constantly forget these things. Okay, let's plan. How can we plan? Then you talk it out. Just by that, and especially the child doing it, they begin to build those resources in their brain, perhaps to remind themselves or to make a plan. For instance, key loss, losing your keys coming in as an adult. It changed my life when I put a basket at the door where I come in to put my keys, wallet, phone, now phone. But early on, it was just keys because it would be a 15 to 20 minute search in the morning. Where did I put those keys? And it took me a while, but I trained and trained and trained and have one place where it's now a ritual. This is a way to low-tech train or deal with the brain problem or the brain difference that often leads to chronic time wasted.
Today's episode of the Brain Science Podcast is sponsored by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download for signing up as a new member at audiblepodcast.com/brainscience. there's some other aspects of ADD that are less well known. When I was reading your book, I was mostly reading The User's Guide to the Brain, although I know you wrote another book. What's the other book? Driven to Distraction?
Right.
Do you think that one is still useful to people, Driven to Distraction? Is it up to date enough?
Oh, yeah. I think it still is. It gives a very good subjective description. Our knowledge certainly has improved, but I think in that book, it's still considered by most people in the field, the Bible, to sort of describe what attentional problems are. I do think that with Dr. Hallowell and I putting that out back then, it really had a big impact and is still very much right on. We did another one in 2002 or so called Delivered from Distraction, which is a little more current, but is really a reflection back on Driven. So both of them are, I think, useful to understand things. The Delivered is a more current one, though.
Another problem that a lot of people seem to have has to do with anger and impulsivity. Can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. That's a big problem with ADD. People often have temper tantrums, problems with impulsive reactions to things. And you see this in children all the time that have uncontrollable rages or temper problems. In adults with the new DSM-5, it may be included as a diagnostic category. It's going to be adults with attention deficit disorder for the first time. And I know one of the symptoms that people were considering is road rage, which is a big problem with adults with ADD. But basically, it's a problem in having that survival switch turned on too quickly and seeing it as a survival issue as opposed to just something that you have to deal with. And so your energy goes into the response to what you perceive as a threat, like, for instance, the child having not done something right and seeing the threat being that they're going to be shamed again or have to pay the consequences, whatever that might be. They flip into a defensive posture without even thinking. They go right to the extreme and throw a tantrum. And on the road, if you're driving behind somebody and they're just lollygagging along and you want to go, 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 for whatever reason, and that's a big part of it because oftentimes there's no reason other than you want to have the free path to go as fast as you'd like, you can get into a rage. And this is what drives many of my adults coming in early on is now too have this as a part of their symptom package, that they can't stand driving. They wish that they had howitzers in their headlights so that they could flip a switch and in a video game kind of way get rid of the frustrating piece that's in front of them. It's really a problem in managing that aggression button. And I think that part of that is due to not having enough of a control over the amygdala or the anger button. It's too sensitive at times, and so it can lead to an over-response on its own. And then also because the frontal cortex isn't as turned on as it needs to be in those situations to help put the brakes on, because that's the ultimate brake setter to say, okay, now don't fly into a rage. Let's consider what really is happening. And you can train yourself, and that's what happens with the child and the adult. They train themselves to work on putting the brakes on before it gets really out of control.
Does something like meditation help with that?
Meditation can help, certainly. Exercise helps enormously, as well as, of course, medication. Those all can help stem the tide. One is sort of training your brain by getting calmer, decreasing that trigger, improving the frontal cortex at the same time. Exercise helps you stimulate all those great neurotransmitters that have to do with activating your frontal cortex and keeping the sort of arousal centers less on edge, if you will. And then medication, dopamine stimulants like Ritalin and Adderall and some of the antidepressants can also help because they help turn on this system that is a little bit flagging and then over-responds and overreacts.
So that's why the drugs like Ritalin, which on the face of it a non-expert would think would be the exact opposite thing that you would need. It's because of that dopamine deficiency issue that those stimulant type drugs actually help.
Yes, and that's what most people don't get. They say, oh, how can you give a stimulant to somebody who has these rage attacks? It is counterintuitive, and what it really does is turn on our inhibitory powers, and it helps us inhibit better, including the rage attack. So, yes, there's a lot of counterintuitive stuff involved with attentional issues, and that's one of them.
We've been sort of alluding all along to the role of the frontal lobes. Is there anything else about the frontal lobes that we could talk about in regard to this? I mean, they're kind of at the top of this whole attentional system, right?
Right. Well, yeah, and I think that's where training comes in, and ritualization, and real practice comes in. Practice in doing things, just like with the basket for my keys. It's training. And so now I even feel uncomfortable if I take my keys out in the house and I haven't gone to the basket yet. So I go directly there. It's sort of a lockstep. And that's part of the training that goes on. And training, for instance, one of the ways of working with tantruming children is to help them discuss with themselves or write out all the issues that were going on when they flew into the rage, whose fault it was, why they had this response and reaction, how bad they felt, to get them to consider it. And when you do that, you begin to work the frontal cortex in and hopefully begin to train up resources up there that aren't there yet, that you make it stronger to help them put the brakes on. In like manner, one of the things that we've seen over the years now is with our adults especially, and with children, on medication, they can begin to do things more appropriately, more like they want to do them, or that they wish they could. And they begin to set standards for themselves, set ideas of what they think of themselves, set expectations for themselves, and train with the medication's help sometimes, train themselves to be more organized, to plan better, to consider their response before they respond a little bit more, to give them a couple seconds before they scream out or have an impulsive response. Over time, they begin to incorporate that, and what we see with our adults is a drop-off in the use of medicine. Most people were always afraid, oh, you're going to go up the ladder, and pretty soon they're going to be having more and more and more. Really, I mean, I've seen hundreds and thousands of people with ADD, really, that many. Over the years now, and almost none of them, maybe one or two, especially younger adults and adolescents certainly, have had problems with their medicine. Problems in terms of using it to stimulate themselves or have a party or sell it. Those are problems in the past. But most adults don't climb the ladder. That is, they don't go up and up and up and up. They use it basically at a level which we think of as medication, and they think of, and they know what they need, and they don't abuse it, and they don't party with it, so that it's really shown over the years, and now I think it's everybody's pretty clear on it, that it isn't an open door to further, you know, escalation of the dose. At times it changes, certainly. But that's a real change in need as opposed to, oh, they just want to get higher and higher.
And I guess people might have also gotten a misimpression just because of the overlapping of addiction problems that you can tend to see.
Right.
But once you treat people, then they can also have a better chance at overcoming their addictions, I would think.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And that's what we know from the adolescent studies, where looking at kids who were treated with medicine versus those who were untreated, the incidence of substance abuse problems in the early 20s are twice as much as those kids who were treated throughout their adolescence. And in the large meta-analysis study shows that those that were treated had about the same incidence of substance abuse problems as the normal population, where those who were untreated ADD folks had twice as much. So again, it sort of points up to the counterintuitive nature of this disorder and treatment of it.
But basically, your experience seems to indicate, as far as the frontal lobes especially, that we can really tap into our brain's plasticity to treat this condition, right?
Yep.
They're basically building new connections as they work on their better habits. That gives them the hope of getting off the medicine, maybe.
Right, right. No, exactly. And I think everybody's all excited all the time about the new uses of technology to help train the brain. The posit science and people with the brain games and the brain gyms that really sort of help train your focusing. They hold some hope in the future of really making a difference. And the number of computerized training modules have been developed over time that have been proved to be useful. Maybe not as useful as medicine, but and not as quick. But they can help reverse the inability to do certain things. And certainly we see this in posit science, as Michael Mesnarek's group has really shown a lot about how, in a scientific way and measurement way, that he can help stem the tide of cognitive decline. And they now are looking at working seriously with improving attention in people who have attention deficits. So I think there's a lot that's hopeful. We need more time, and I think it's developing. There are other issues about training. For instance, one of the newer findings in the past 10 years has been the inclusion of the cerebellum as a big part of the attentional system. We all know that the cerebellum, up until the 90s, was considered only involved with motor skills. Well, we know a lot more now that it's involved with every system in the brain, that it's a little lobe in the back of the brain that's involved with balance and rhythm, keeping time. I call it the rhythm and blues center of the brain. And it does do that. It keeps our systems, our memory system, our attentional system, our emotional system, our ability to speak, all in a continuous flowing pattern more than not. If you don't have it, everything is discontinuous, not just your motor movements. Well, this is an area that is very sensitive to stimulants and very much studied by a number of investigators as involved with attentional problems. And by training that area of the brain, one might see a real improvement in attention. There's a center called the DORE Center, D-O-R-E, that my colleague Ned Halliwell has been working with. This is a group that just trains up the cerebellum, and they had some good data on its usefulness in dyslexia. There's some hope that it might have some effect in training the cerebellum to help with the attentional system, but that is still under investigation. It's not solid, certainly, but there are certainly self-reports of people who have improved. But one of the things to just sort of emphasize is this is where all kinds of training can come in. For instance, doing complicated exercise involves the entire brain, but certainly the cerebellum, because it's involved with coordinating our movements as well as our thinking. As you get better in certain movements, your attention system gets better, in part, I think, because your cerebellum, which is very easily trained, by the way, can be trained fairly quickly and very well to hold your attention more together. It doesn't split apart. One of the ways many patients describe ADD from a subjective point of view is their attention is discontinuous. It sort of goes on and then off, and then they have to wake themselves up to be back on. On meaning on the stimuli in front of them. Well, the cerebellum is very much involved with that. So doing something like yoga or core training can and does improve our attention system. And it is something that in the future, I think we're going to see more and more of a focus on how this impacts our attentional system as well as other emotional areas that are involved with the continuity and flow aspect of our brains and our psyche.
You mentioned in your book Spark about how kids with ADD often do really well when they get into something like martial arts, and that kind of focuses in that direction, both the cerebellum and plus it gives you that kind of survival attention getter too, I guess.
Yes, for sure. It's all about just that. It's about that complicated, complex motor involvement that really grabs the whole attention system, because the attention system is very much, it's allied with and part of the movement system. And that's why I think it's so important to sort of focus on that for understanding and treatment in the future for our ADHD issues out there.
We're just about out of time, so I'm going to ask you one last question for my listeners. What do you think is the most important thing that you want them to remember of our conversation?
Well, I think the most important thing is that ADD is, one, a genetic issue. Okay, there is a biologic basis for those that are outside the norm. And also that our culture is helping us see more of what ADD is. It's not the whole story, but if you think back 20, 40 years ago, we didn't have nearly, not just because we got better at diagnosis, but we didn't have nearly the incidence of people who have attentional issues. And I do think that we need to pay much more attention to the cultural issues that are wonderful in many regards, our ability not to do things because everything is done cyber-wise for us, that we need to deal with this in a more constructive way and understand it, and then help those with the attentional issues change, help them to change where they're at and where they're going to be in the future.
For those of us who might have a friend or family member that's affected, what should we do besides be more aware?
Be more aware and have them be more aware and have them accept the fact that this is part of their life that they have to deal with. And I think that's the overwhelming issue, is for the person with ADD or people who love them, they need to help them constantly remind them that they have to deal with it and train themselves and set up their environment in such a way that they can be much more successful and take advantage of their gifts, because like Michael Phelps and Rick Warren, those very current ADDers who are on the front pages, show that if you get the right mission and you get enough support to go with it, that it can really be beneficial to us all.
Thank you. And thank you so much for teaching me about this, because I really wouldn't have been aware of these things. And I think that that means there's a lot of other people that really still have old ideas about what ADD is. It's not just an excuse. It's something you can deal with.
Exactly. And I think that's what's important. And hopefully we'll move forward with that in mind.
Great. Well, John, it was great to have you back on the Brain Science Podcast. I need another reason to ask you back on the show. If you think of one, just let me know.
Okay, I will. I certainly will. Maybe we can talk about the schools and how we need to reinvigorate the schools at some point in time. But I love being with you and love this whole enterprise. So congratulations to you, and thank you for having me again. I'm honored.
Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye. Thank Dr. Reddy for taking the time to talk with us. You probably noticed that this interview was recorded during the Olympics, since Dr. Reddy made reference to Michael Phelps having won 6 out of 8 gold medals. Michael Phelps did win all 8 gold medals. There was a question that I meant to ask Dr. Reddy that I forgot to ask him, and that was about whether or not there's any evidence that NutraSweet makes the symptoms of ADD worse. So I sent him an email asking him this question. This is what he said. Quote, "There is no solid evidence about the NutraSweet thing, but there is a remarkable effect on using fish oil, our true snake oil. In a fairly large crossover study from Australia, kids with ADHD put on omega-3s had a nice significant improvement on most measures of intention and behavior. We recommend using the higher EPA DHA variety like Barry Sears, the Zone Guy, or Omega Bright, which is my favorite," end quote. I'm sure you can think of some other questions that I could have asked Dr. Reddy. He mentioned to me before this interview how much he enjoyed receiving emails about his first interview back in episode 33. So I will be sure to put a link to his website and books in the show notes. If you're listening to this episode right when it comes out, it's looking like I'm not going to get the show notes out at the same time as the episode, like I usually do. But the show notes will be available on the website brainsciencepodcast.com within a few days. Don't forget that you can send me email at docartemis@gmail.com. You can also post your comments and share your ideas with other listeners at the discussion forum at brainscienceforum.com. If you would like to help support the Brain Science Podcast, you will find information about how to do this at brainsciencepodcast.com. That's where you will also find links to all of my other projects, including my other podcast books and ideas, and the website sciencepodcasters.org. There's also links to all the other groups for the Brain Science Podcast, including those on Facebook and Flickr. Our next episode is going to be the one that I recorded at DragonCon in Atlanta, Georgia last weekend. I'll be talking with two research scientists about functional MRI brain imaging. The great thing about this episode was that there was an opportunity for the audience to ask questions, so I think you'll really enjoy that. Until then, I want to thank everyone for listening, and I look forward to talking to you all again in a couple of weeks. The Brain Science Podcast is copyright 2008 Virginia Campbell, MD. You may copy this podcast to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at docartemis@gmail.com.